This is 1360 AM.
WNJC. Washington Township. Philadelphia. Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station. Brought to you from Forsyth Broadcasting. Or listen to us at WNJCRadio.com.
All right, welcome. This is your host, Will Hemingway, and you are listening to the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. No tinfoil hats here, no ranting rhetoric, simple, stoic, thoughtful enlightenment on training in risk management, preparedness, and proactive survival. Survival is every day, so live well. The Practice Preparedness Radio Show comes to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on WNJC 1360 AM, South Jersey, Philadelphia. As always, listen to us live on the internet via my website, practicepreparedness.com. We stream every time on TuneIn. Find a link on our website via the Listen Live button, or if you are in the Delaware Valley, you can listen live at 1360 on your AM radio. As always, you can stream the past shows. You will find them archived on the website under show notes or select one from the scrolling list on the website's right column. Thanks for joining us. I am your host, Will Hemingway. I want to stimulate your little gray cells. Let's get started. Good evening. I am Will Hemingway, and let's get started. The show today will be presented in a new format. It'll be broken down into three segments and a summary review at the end. The segments will be approximately 15 minutes each, and the idea is that you will be able to listen in a short session on lunch, work breaks, or when you have limited time. This segment is entitled Stability in Mind, Body, and Thought. So when we begin looking at a problem, whatever it is, a stable mind and body contributes to a balanced, stoic approach to life and all of its challenges. Stoicism teaches a person to constrain emotion and live thoughtfully and logically. One of the lessons that I learned as I began following the Stoic path was that it is not to say that you don't want to have emotions, but to recognize that emotions take you out of a sense of objective reality and move you into a place where you are bouncing about on the walls like a ball in a pinball machine, rolling without help, without control, bouncing off the walls and bumpers, waiting for the result that you have no control over. You have control. The control is of the emotions. The control, or the management, is of the mind. You can manage your mind. You can determine what you are going to do. You will not always have control of the outcome, but you can certainly manage it by managing your responses, managing the way that you approach it in the first place. This gives you the positive outcome. I'm not saying that you should be cold-blooded psychopaths or a mindless Borg. Simply put, unchecked emotions precipitate in unintended behaviors and unintended outcomes, all that being the butterfly effect. That is the key. If you experience high highs and low low, you need to seek help or work really hard to evolve your perspective and responses immediately. Time is of the essence. It is not if, but when you will cause yourself irreparable harm, either physically, mentally, or legally. Many, many people, especially in what we would refer to as civilized Western societies, have way too much time on their hands and become way too emotionally driven and end up in jail, end up in trouble, ruin their lives, cause themselves countless amounts of heartache and expense that divert them from having a quality life. One should never act on impulse except to jump out of the way from an oncoming truck. Those things should not be emotional either. If you practice the process of creating neural pathways and build them with well-planned and fact-based responses, you will survive anything. If you live where there is snow and ice, you should go into a parking lot when there's snow and ice out, far from poles, curbs, and other vehicles. Run your vehicle up to speeds, then try to turn, observe the results, test the limits of safe and unsafe results. Slam on the brakes while you're going straight, see how long it takes you to stop, get a feel, do it several times, do it in different areas so that you can get a feel on a hill, and so forth. You will never know the outcome and never know how to prepare for it properly until you have actually experienced it. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to take drugs to know that taking drugs unnecessarily is bad. You can look at the experiential data. There's a lot of it. But test the things that you are going to be expected to respond to physically and mentally. When you actually experience a situation in the real world, once you have practiced, there will be no heart pounding. There will be no shaking hands. You will be cool, calm, and be able to manage the situation well. You can never calculate all the variables in life. That's just the way it goes. But what you can do, what you must do, is be able to give yourself the absolute best options that you can find in order to guarantee and assure yourself the best outcome at the end. That's the key. Don't wait until the moment that it happens for that to be the first time that you have considered the potential of what happens. These high highs and low lows are identified within the psychological community as borderline personality disorders, BPD. It's a mental disorder defined by the National Institute of Mental Health as a mental illness in people which exhibit unstable behavior, moods, and relationships, all a result of experiencing high highs and low lows. Try to learn to find the middle. These moderated responses. Being happy is an emotion. Finding happiness or finding contentness where you don't have to feel pushed around, where you don't have to feel uncomfortable, where you don't, remember, these are all feelings, and you don't have to feel threatened. These are key. Another player in this game is drug addiction, including legal drugs, alcohol, prescription drugs, etc. They dull our senses and magnifies others. The addiction itself causes the human mind to behave erratically. It does not make a person bad, but the outcome is the same either way. If you're high or impaired and you crash your car into someone head-on and kill them, good or bad, they're still dead. The legal results are no different whether you started out being a sociopath or a psychopath and killed someone, were just a crazed murderer, or you were high. It doesn't matter. You still killed someone. There may be some deviation whether they determine whether it was manslaughter or murder, but in the end, it's still the same, and your life is basically over. Bipolar behavior is a troubling and common diagnosis in modern Western cultures. Modern Western cultures have the luxury of having all of these problems, and I use those words very liberally, because in other countries where they're not so lucky as us, people worry about sleeping with one eye open and not being raped, killed, murdered, mutilated, tortured. And here we hang ourselves because we don't have an iPhone 7 like everyone else on the block does. I believe that in most cases, bipolarism and many of the other so-called psychological and borderline personality disorders, the real problem is laziness and lack of personal responsibility. Every human is born with natural impulsive natures. Read the first five preface pages of the book, The Caucasian Knot, The History and Geopolitics of Nagorno-Karabakh, and or The Night That Attila Died, Solving the Murder of Attila the Hun. These two books really put it in perspective for people who don't know real world history. You will never again dispute my approach that humans are naturally lazy, greedy, and violent after you have read the prefaces to those two books. You don't even need to read the whole book, though I highly recommend both of them. As civilized humans living in a civilized culture, we learn to check our natural urges to fit into a loosely knitted latticework of social norms. These norms are under attack every day by people who don't want to bother, who have no understanding of history and the result of allowing people to just run without any controls, and the damage, destruction, and selfish nature of humans that will come out when left unchecked. Anger and its lesser behavior, frustration, are two of the most common emotional threats in the world. When people are angry, when they're frustrated, it is a result of a failure to defeat a challenge. Whether the challenge was wrought on you, or imposed upon you, or you brought it upon yourself by lack of action, the result does not change. If you lash out, you lash out with emotion, and that emotional response is going to have a very negative long-term impact. It makes you feel fulfilled for the moment, but it never ends up fulfilling you in the long end. Reactivism, which is what comes from that, is a failed strategy. In fact, it is evidence of poor planning, failure, and actions. Reactive behaviors play to the popular desire to blame others. If you wish to live a happy, stable life, you must take responsibility for yourself, your safety, your security, your stability, your shelter, etc. None of those are subjective emotional anomalies. They are measurable, hard, factual assessments of status. In May 2017, there was what was dubbed a worldwide ransomware attack, or what was referred to as a cybercrime attack, using an exploit called WannaCry, WannaCry. In the early stages of this incident, several computers that handled appointments for outpatient care in hospitals in the UK were affected. The ransomware locked down the computers, encrypting the data on the hard drive, and demanding $300 in bitcoins be placed into an account, in an anonymous account with Bitcoin. The word began to spread across the world rapidly, and the disaster, of course, because it was attached to a computer in a hospital, and all kinds of extrapolations from this came out, and the news media went crazy. It became a 24/7 news story about this worldwide attack. It started in England, it moved in, and by the end of it, they say that it affected computers in 150 countries. This sounds dramatic and disastrous. There were cries for why the President of the United States didn't make a comment because it was such a big deal. There were calls for investigations and all this blather. But in the end, let's look at the difference between how the emotional response was perceived and then the actual objective view of the facts and the non-emotional responses and the non-emotional facts that precipitated from the incident within a few days. So, in the beginning, a person who was a cybersecurity specialist looked at the code using a hacker that they dealt with to crack into the code of the ransomware and identify something. And as a result, he purchased a URL for $10 and immediately stopped the function of the ransomware for at least a short while until it mutated itself, buying as much as 24 hours time before it started to affect computers again, giving nations like the US and others the opportunity to act to block it. And Microsoft identified that there was a weakness in one of their networking codecs, and as a result, they pushed out an update that would correct the problem and close the opportunity for an exploit. So what started with being told all over on CNN, MSNBC, Sky News, Fox, all over the world, was that this was a phishing email that then planted something on a computer, and that when the computer rebooted, that it took over the computer, it had a trigger in time, and so forth. In fact, we now know that none of that was true. We know that it was an exploit that, when it sniffed the networks, it looked for computers that had this exploit where there was a weakness, where the computer was not behind a firewall, hardware firewall, or was not running a viable software firewall, got into the system and was able to alter key important data on the base root of the hard drive and then lock it down. So, this sounds really bad. Here's the point of me bringing this up. Unscrupulous computer support people exploited the hype to push clients into spending money on upgrades, new security software, and lots of billable time. I could have made a fortune from my clients by telling them what they were saying on the news, but I was reading write-ups about it in one of the number one points in the world on cybercrime and security, and that was SANS. And while I was reading their information, and I attended two webinars within the first few hours after this exploit had started happening, I was clearly convinced that a well-secured system was not going to be exploited for this unless people were abusing the computer. One of the biggest threats, of course, with all of these are people going, visiting, and downloading photos from porn sites, especially the free ones, where you can go to and view pictures and videos from all kinds of other sites for free, have been tampered with in order to give you all kinds of exploitive keystroke capturing software and other exploits that open up ports in order to fish and give information outside, even through the best security systems. Please, if you're going to do these things, talk to someone who's a specialist who can help set you up to give you security when you're doing it and not threaten your critical data. With that said, people were exploiting the public. And this is what happens in the prepping community. When we talk about these missiles going up into the air with these demonstrations from North Korea and such, we get into a scenario that is very, very similar to that of these situations. You must put yourself in the mindset where you don't let emotions take over. You must put yourself in the mindset that you will use facts. You will pay attention. You pay attention to the realities of the situation, but you must pay attention to the facts. So that's that for setting the mindset. Now we're going to move into the next segment, which is the realities of EMP and the threat that it poses. This segment's title is The Realities of EMP. Accepting the premise that I have previously presented regarding the stability of mind, thought, and body, reactivism is off of the table. I will approach this segment based upon that idea and utilizing and applying objective thought, reason, analytical responses and behaviors. All responses, whether they are in the implementation of planning, policy, or actions, must be devoid of emotional reactive behaviors. That does not mean that EMP is not a threat. But even being faced with the imminent danger of a person with a gun facing you in the room, coming at you and threatening you, an emotional reactive response is not wise. This gun scenario is a highly debated subject, but factually proven with real-world results. People say all the time, never bring a knife to a gunfight. That is completely absurd. Even when a person has a gun and intends to use it offensively, not defensively, in reaction to a person who is within 21 feet of them who has a knife, the likelihood is the person with the gun will die if the person with the knife has the intent to kill them. Even if they don't, the likelihood is that they will die, because knife wound victims have a much more high likelihood of killing a person than that of a gunshot. Simple fact. Easily backed by uniform crime report studies and data going back 30 and 40 years. Here's the thing. If you go in to a situation like that with improper expectations, believing that they have a gun so you're dead, and you just acquiesce and submit, you will probably die. The reality is that if you know the facts that I just presented and you actually approach it that way, you have a chance of surviving. If you don't, you will be a victim for sure. Do not allow yourself to be a victim. This applies whether it's in a person threatening you with a gun or with some other threat. Inaction is action. Don't give your ability to respond to the one who is attacking you. In the case of the EMP, it is the boogeyman. It is the 800-pound gorilla in the room for the last 70 years. A sidebar note, if you don't know that saying, 800-pound gorilla is an American English an expression for a person or an organization so powerful that it can act without regard to the rights of others or the law. The phrase is rooted in an old joke, a riddle. Where does an 800-pound gorilla sit? To which the answer is, anywhere it wants to. This highlights the disparity of power between the 800-pound gorilla and everything else. The term can describe a powerful geopolitical military force, a business, a powerful corporate entity that is so large and has such a majority percentage of whatever market that they compete in, that they can use their strength to crush all would-be competitors. Or it could be a military, or it could be a nation and the perception of their military. Whatever it is, the metaphor includes an inherent bit of hyperbole, a small slight, a joke. The highest weight yield yet recorded for an actual obese gorilla is 600 pounds. The average weight is 400. So imagine an 800-pound gorilla, even amongst other gorillas, they would have the upper hand. Let me explain a little bit about EMP. We did not get a chance to do that when I had Dr. Peter Pry on the first time. I wanted to make sure that I underscored it. We can't really cover this topic in depth without recognizing that there's more than just EMP. There's EMR and TPR. So let me give you a brief explanation. EMP, or an EMR incident, the more exposure to radiation, the more severe the short and long-term effects are on the human body. Some radiation exposure is natural in our environment. It's critical to limit radiation exposure as much as possible or as practical. EMR, created by the rapid atomized by an explosion dispersal of non-fissioned components of both a nuclear fission device or a non-nuclear device containing radioactive isotopes, materials in the form of large amounts of EMR, electromagnetic radiation. It consists mainly of soft X-rays. EMR is absorbed rapidly in the surrounding atmosphere, rapidly heating it to extremely high temperatures, forming a hot sphere of air and gaseous residues. The fireball grows within milliseconds. A 1 megaton detonation expands a fireball to 150 meters. Within 10 milliseconds, a 1 megaton expands the fireball to 2,200 meters. Fireball rises at a rate of 100 meters per second. That heat rising, the rapid expansion of the fireball, massively compresses the surrounding atmosphere, creating a devastating blast wave. The fireball cools within 1 minute, no longer, emitting radiation, forming a mushroom cloud. TPR is a thermal pulse radiation, 35% of the energy expelled, temperatures of 40 to 70 million degrees centigrade in the immediate area of a detonation, vaporizing anything directly at the blast point. Nuclear radiation, 15% of the energy from a nuclear explosion, is expelled. Initial ionizing radiation, 5%, primarily neutron, X, and gamma rays emitted in the first minute of an EMP burst, and the result of an EMR. So let's go into what the effects are of an EMR. The electromagnetic pulse or radiation potentially melts solid-state electronics in seconds without warning. The only possible way to protect sensitive electronics is to place them in a Faraday cage. You can go to practicesurvival.com, go to the area that says useful info, and drill down in. You'll find the Faraday cage there on the list on the right side, and you can read about it. I have a simple primer there that can take you elsewhere to learn more. It's easy to make a Faraday cage. I even have that on one of the associated pages. In the event of an EMP-EMR event, vehicles with electronic ignitions, engine computers, GPS units, radios, cell phones, and other electronics may be completely destroyed all around you in seconds. You may not, and likely will not, with the super EMPs that have no nuclear part of their components, see a mushroom cloud, feel or see the results of a blast wave, see a fire, see heat. None of that will occur. It will be an aerial detonation. That is the maximum effect. The EMR will also affect you. If you have a pacemaker, the results could be instantaneously. The rest of us may be affected too, but how much depends on the power, the level of power of the EMP event. EMP can disrupt brain waves, cause nausea, dementia, cancer, and more. High levels of EMR emitted from cell phones and high-tension power lines have demonstrated that they can cause bees to become disoriented, fail to pollinate, and not return to the hive. It is a destructive effect on vehicles, communications, and other electronics. The military that many survivalists fear, their sensitive equipment could be destroyed. So they place spares in Faraday cages, store spare components and parts, even return to EMP-proof vehicles that don't rely on electronics to run. It's really important to understand, though, what exactly that means, because when we talk about the effects, it's critical that you understand that those effects have not been well documented. I will put a link on the page for this show to the Homeland Security Committee hearings on electromagnetic pulse, threat to infrastructure, critical infrastructure. And there are lots of videos on there and associated results that will tell you lots and lots of things that you need to know. But understand, part of what came out of that, which I'll have a link there to the futurescience.com site, here is an excerpt. I'll read you a quick piece from it, from the EMP Commission's Critical National Infrastructures Report. Quote, automobiles. The potential EMP vulnerability of automobiles derives from the use of built-in electronics that support multiple automotive functions. Electronic components were first introduced into automobiles in the late 1960s. As time passed and electronics technologies evolved, electronic applications in automobiles proliferated. Modern automobiles have as many as 100 microprocessors that control virtually all functions. While electronic applications have proliferated within electronics in automobiles, so too have application standards and electromagnetic interference and electromagnetic compatibility practices. Thus, while it may be expected that increased EMP vulnerability would accompany the proliferated electronics application, this trend, at least in part, is mitigated by the increased application of EMI-EMC practices. So let me break that down real quick. In other words, they found that though there are more electronics in the cars, that the possible effect and negative outcome of an EMP striking them has gone down because they have been slowly incorporating EMP hardening into these systems. Now, the more micro size that these electronics become, the more vulnerable they become because they work and function on lower voltages and lower amperages. So it's a give and take. Automobiles, and here's a really critical thing. We tested a sample of 37 cars in an EMP simulation laboratory with automobile vintages ranging from 1986 through 2002. Automobiles of these vintages include extensive electronics and represent a significant fraction of automobiles on the road today. The testing was conducted by exposing running and non-running automobiles to sequentially increasing EMP field intensities. If anomalous response, either temporary or permanent, were observed, the testing of that particular vehicle was stopped. If an anomalous response was observed, the testing was continued. If no anomalous response was observed, the test was continued up to the field intensity limits of the simulation capability, approximately 50 kVm. Automobiles were subjected to EMP environments under both engine turned off and engine turned on conditions. No effects were subsequently observed in those automobiles that were not turned on during EMP. This is big. That means if your car is off and an EMP happens, it's likely your car will start and run. The most serious effect observed on running automobiles was that the motors in three cars stopped at field strengths of approximately 30 kVm or above. In an actual EMP exposure, these vehicles would glide to a stop and require the driver to restart them. Electronics in the dashboard of one automobile were damaged and required repair. Other effects were relatively minor. 25 automobiles exhibited malfunctions that could be considered only a nuisance, blinking dashboard lights, etc., and it required no intervention by the driver. So let me be clear. This is key. In the end, in truck tests, 13 of 18 trucks exhibited a response while running. Most seriously, 3 truck motors stopped. 2 could be restarted immediately. Only 1 required repairs. None that were not running were affected at all. Period. So let's put that in perspective. That means that if your vehicle is off, it's probably still going to run. This changes the entire approach of what we have been taught and blabbed to by preppers and all these doomsdayers who talk about all kinds of problems. Here is the simple fact. A little preparation goes a long way. In all these tests, even in the incidents where they did result in a negative result, they found that the engine computer, the transmission computer, the spark plugs, and the light bulbs were the things affected, headlights, taillights, etc. If that's the case, then I proffer placing 1 spare of each of those into a Faraday cage, putting it in your trunk, will give you the maximum effect to guarantee no matter where you are or what condition your vehicle is in when an EMP occurs, you will still have mobility and transportation. Period. End of story. The only real world information that we have in the real world of an EMP happening happened both in the late 50s with the Bikini Island tests, 1 aerial test that happened after that by the U.S. government in 1962, and then recent events where there have been attacks on power grids in Yemen and other places in the Middle East that took down their grids for 3 months, 3 weeks, depending upon the location. But let's talk real world. EMP is a threat. If it stops your communications and your phone stops working, then we're in trouble. If you don't have the internet, then most people will lose their mind. This is what will happen. But none of these things cannot be overcome. The real threat is to massive, large-size systems like the power grid that do not have EMP proofing built in them because our government has been remiss at acting proactively. If you really want to see a result, take some minor steps for yourself and take some major, major steps in pressing your local federal representatives to get on it and get things done on implementing systems and protections from EMP. Dr. Peter Pry talked about it, and you can go back and listen to the show that was on the 6th of May, 2017. On EMP, he spoke about the fact in one of his books that in Maine, he went there, presented to them, they had nothing, they didn't even know what EMP was, and within 6 months, they had legislation pushing forward to make massive sweeping changes to protect their system. 2 years later, they're in the best position in the entire United States. How sad is it that a small state like that could act that well and the federal government failed to do that? This is where we come in pressing our people in the government to represent us wisely in order to protect us. Forget worrying about stadiums and this and that. People pick it in the street to get a new stadium and have it paid for by taxpayer money and have it government organized, but they don't pay any attention to these things that are most critical. You can visit practicepreparedness.com. I'll put the link down the bottom in the show page to take you to the part on EMP to enlighten you. And that'll be all for now on this segment of the realities of EMP. Thank you for listening. The title of this segment is Modern Society, Urbanism, and Societal Survival. The issue with living within an urban Western society is that it has largely become relegated to urban mentality, urban dominance. Even though the mass majority of the populace in most nations still is not based in an urban area, the policies and social norms that are created, and I use norm very loosely, are created and pushed forth by people who live and exist in an urban environment. The survival of a society requires at least a balance between urban and rural mentality. A very close friend of mine and I had a very in-depth conversation recently about his perspective, having grown up in a very rural setting, moving into the city, his expectations and experiences moving from a very rural northwestern city into Europe to go to school, being presented with socialist and communal living mentalities of the European environment, and the way that he ebbed and flowed back and forth as he was convinced early on that living in the city, the only people who are intelligent live in the city. He later grew and evolved to recognize the value of both sides. There's certainly no question that if you're talking about fine detailed, knowing where the fork and the knife goes and in what order on the of the silverware being placed onto a napkin and where the napkin goes and how you set and so forth, all those matters of social etiquette are going to be much higher likely to be found within an urban environment. Education is largely associated to an urban environment. All of the major universities and colleges across the civilized world all exist within mostly urban environments. Why? Because everyone goes there, so they all cleave to that. Why is it that I tell every prepper, every survivalist, every preparedness person to always look where they're going to move and move somewhere where they are not in one of the following? Don't live in a city. Don't live on the edge of a city. Don't move into a county seat. Even if it is in a rural area, if you live in the county seat, you will be besieged by the highest amount of problems, social, deviance, threats, crime, you name it, it's there. Why? Because people who have problems, people who interact with the system of the government, have the desire to be closest to that with which they interact every day. If you can't drive because you lost your license, or because you can't afford to have a car, or because you're on welfare, or because you have a disability, or and, you're going to wish to live where you can get up, walk out of your place of living, and walk to the things that you need. Social services, food, water, etc., etc. If you live in a rural area, you are demanded to be basically self-reliant and self-sustaining. This is the reality. If you have to drive a half an hour to 45 minutes to get to the Wawa or the Wendy's or to get to Walmart or the feed store to feed your animals, you become very self-sufficient. You become very well regimented. You become very structured. And over a period of time, you have a very firm grasp on time and doing time maintenance for yourself, because if you don't, you will waste a lot of what you don't have, and then you won't have a lot of what you need. This is the reality. In modern society, we have, because of the accoutrements, the value that we have gotten back from having the things that we get as a result: cars, boats, airplanes, libraries, schools, businesses, TV, internet, etc., etc. All these things have made us soft. I'm not complaining. I love partaking in them. But I am always carefully rooted in the idea that if something happened and it went away, I would still survive. That's the reality. When I want to be able to survive, I can't look at the things that come from those constructs that we make, those false realities, those things that are propping us up. If we didn't have the things we did, a lot of people you know would probably die. When we talk about EMP, I talked about it in some other segments with Dr. Peter Pry, and when I talked about the effects of EMP on both humans and on the world about us, if you have a pacemaker and an EMP goes off, and you live only as a result of that pacemaker consistently zapping you to keep you alive, you're in trouble. This is the reality of the difference between modern society and the way it used to be with rural society. You would have just died. I'm not saying that's great. I'm simply saying you have to know the limits and the reality. If you live every day as a result of having to take certain drugs, what will you do if those drugs are no longer available tomorrow? Because of societal unrest, because of a war, because of a natural disaster. What if that interruption in normal services and supplies lasts 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years? Look, if you were in the Philippines, people in the Philippines had an incident in 2010, I believe it was, and they were hit by a hurricane, and they still have no infrastructure repaired yet today. This is the reality. That is the real world happening today in this world that we live in. You must understand that it's critical to maintain a mentality that says, I know I enjoy living in the world and I don't want to be ostracized because I live in the country and live like a country bumpkin. But you must know what it takes to live without the things you have, at least for some time, and could ramp up to doing it even longer. This is why I promote things like gardening, suburban homesteading. If you practice these things every day when you don't have to, you will create the neural pathways and the experiences that will give you a leg up that if you had to do it and something unexpected or unfathomable did happen, like in the GridX situation where they talked about an EMP or a cyber attack that downed the electrical grid from Boston to DC for 90 days. When we look at these things, we know that if the government's looking at that as a possibility, they are a real threat. If that happened, have you built experiences for yourself that will make it into a viable, survivable thing? Or will you end up being a refugee begging from the government and other groups for food, shelter, etc.? Think about that now. What have you done to protect yourself, your family, your community? It is not just you. If you do not work with your neighbors, they will become the ones who take what you have, and you both will die in a result of that. But if you build skills, they can't steal them from you. Someone may steal your supplies, but they won't be able to steal your skills. They are barterable. They will make you important, make you valuable, and make you worth keeping alive. This is the time to prepare. Do not get sucked into this urban mentality that says, oh, please, it'll never happen. There are too many of us. We've got it covered. Look what we have. It's all good. In a blink of an eye, they're not going to target the rural areas. They're not going to target the outlying suburban areas. They're going to target the main urban areas, the cities. That's what's going to happen. please, I beg of you that you take some time to get serious about learning about the things that I have covered in the classes, on the practice preparedness classes. Go visit my meetup.com groups, join, give us some ideas of what you want to learn about, and I'll put together some more meetups on those topics. There are some new ones coming up, first Monday and third Thursday of the month. Check that out if you're in the local South Jersey, Philadelphia area. Meanwhile, visit PracticeSurvival.com. Look at the things I have there. Visit PracticeSelfReliance.com. Look at Disaster Preparedness. Look at the PlanForDisaster.com side and SurvivalRisks.com. I have all the links to all of my sites that have a compendium of information for you to learn and educate yourself from. Start small, bite-sized pieces, jump through and practice preparedness. I actually started putting up a training course on there for you to look at. Take a look and lighten yourself, please. That'll be it for this segment, and come back and visit us again. In conclusion, it's important to understand. In conclusion, I think it's critical that everyone understands that it is not simply a matter of reacting to a perceived threat or to a crisis at hand that makes up true survivalism and preparedness. It's about careful, thoughtful, long-term planning, analytical perspectives of things that have happened before, education, the creation of knowledge and skills and experience that happen by treating survival as an activity that is every single day. Whether it's handling a flat tire, whether it's handling a problem with a person near you that you care about having a heart attack or some physical injury, all of these things, the outcomes of which are changed dramatically when you have prepared ahead of time to handle these common problems. Everything in the world can be overcome given time, opportunity, knowledge, experience, and gear. And the key is that you buy time because you don't need as much when you spend time ahead of time practicing and building skills. When you have gear and thoughtfully purchased gear or built or created gear that serves you, that you are familiar with, tasks that take hours take minutes. The results of actions change by you having done them before. You're no longer guessing. You don't hesitate. These are things that are critical that in the end will help you survive and thrive in whatever instance that you come upon. That is the key, and that's what we want. And if you survive, you can help others. And if I survive, I can help others. That is where true survival and preparedness comes down to. No matter how hard and how tough you think you are, we all need others. And we need to have others to live with, deal with, and interact with for a truly fulfilling life. We want to make sure that our community survives. And that's what the last three segments have been all about, establishing the idea that the stability in mind, body, and thought build results because it takes emotion out of the quotient. It's impossible to remove it all, but you can put yourself in a position where you are actually able to react in a way that you've already practiced. So it's controlled, calm response, controlled, positive outcome demanded. And you know what that outcome will be because you've done it before. When you get to that point, it pays off in spades. If the first time that you went to change a tire was when you're stuck in a parking lot that has no lighting on a cold winter day, and they told you your wait is 3 hours for AAA while you have a quarter of a tank of gas left in your car, it's a bad day. But if you waited till then and you don't know, shame on you, not them. This is when you take your time to go out and take a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday and go out and pull your car up in a parking lot, rip everything out of your trunk, and decide how much you don't want all that crap on top of your important spare tire so that when you really need it, you can get to it. You find out that that piece of junk that they gave you, they call a tire iron, the lug wrench, bends on the first try and you can't undo the lug nuts. So you get yourself a crossbar lug wrench for $15, and you get yourself a $50 1.5 ton, or depending upon your vehicle, lightweight aluminum racing jack so that you can jack the car up safely, and some jack stands because you never know how stable where you are is going to be. This is what it's all about. And when I talked in segment 3 about modern society, urbanism, and societal survival, the point is that if you are in a place now where you don't cook because you don't have to, where you don't even know how the food arrives at the store that you get to eat, when you don't even know how to prepare it, store it, or take care of it, let alone if you had no power, this is the time to get started. Look at, pay attention to the way that people used to do things all but 60 years ago, 50 years ago, when they actually prepared their own food. I remember in the 60s, the new thing of the TV dinners occurring, and suddenly my mom stopped cooking, and then she got sick of TV dinners really quickly, and I was put to task to cook at 7-8 years old, because the realities are it's not the same quality of life. You get speed and you get lack of labor, but you get low quality. You gain all the way around by learning how to garden, by learning how to tend your yard and tend your vehicle. Don't leave these things to others. If you are one of those people who say, that's what I work for, I pay other people to take care of it, what will you do in the moment that those people are no longer interested or available to help you? What will you do? There's no calling 911 if the entire grid is down, because even if it is working, everyone who has a phone working will be inundating them with questions and complaints. You must grasp the concept that it is personal responsibility, self-reliance, strong individualism that built this country, that made it great, that you can grasp and grab onto to make yourself have a level of calm and security. Lots of people who I speak to who are borderline on that edge of completely incapable of taking care of themselves, who use terms like someone jokingly said to me the other day, but really meant it, was, that's why I need a husband. No, I thought you were woman, you were strong, you were competent, you were capable. You should be able to take care of those things because we're all equal, but we're not. So that's why we need a level of ability to have a team, to work with our neighbors, to work in our community. You need community to survive. Even the toughest of us need that. Wrapping them all together, you realize that EMP represents a real threat, but it is not the end of the world. It is only the end of the world for those people who think that a chicken is born on a styrofoam tray with a nice little pillow underneath of it and a clear plastic over top of it. You need to build skills, knowledge, and work with others so that in the time of trouble, when you need others and you need those skills, they will be at hand. Not trying to threaten, force, or worm your way in through manipulation. Learn to build relationships, build skills, build knowledge. That's the wonder of things like the meetup groups, like visiting ours. Go to practicepreparedness.com, click on the link to the meetup groups. Keep following and follow me on Twitter. I'll be posting my upcoming events and my classes that won't be with the meetups. Check in with us from time to time. As I always tell you, there is no disaster when prepared. I'm Will Hemingway. Please be safe. Please take some time to prepare. And as always, there is no disaster when you are prepared. Until next week, stay safe, stay ready, and stay alert. It is the key. Situational awareness is everything.